as being one of the people in the agency that actually is in charge of multiple national programs, and he's going to give us a perspective from where he sees things. So without further ado, and I'll let you know, we're going to cheat and steal a few minutes from the business meeting, so I'm not too concerned. I'm running a little over.
Okay, thank you, John. What I'm going to present today will basically reiterate in some aspects or corroborate what Dr. Jacob Jung has mentioned, which makes me feel good because I had no idea what she was going to present before. As you know, we have two sides of the House. Our administrator for administration and line management just spoke, Dr. Simon Liu, and then the Office of National Programs, our administrator for that is Dr. Steve Kappas, and I'm within the Office of National Programs, where I have the distinct privilege of dealing with post-harvest horticulture, new uses, and an added one to me is the whole biofuels, biorefining aspect of it. And I'm also very happy to say this is my scientific organization that I was with as a scientist, and I'm happy to be a fellow of this particular science organization. Of course, I'm going to be dealing with food, and Dr. Jacob Jung introduced this aspect of the nine plus billion people and how we're going to feed them and deal with that food. Responsibility falls on me and my scientists to some degree. But one of the things we need to understand is, where is this population that we're talking about? Where is it going to fall within the developed and the developing world? So if we go back to about the time this research agency was created in the early 1950s, we see that anywhere between 50% of the population or 20% of the population actually lived in our urban areas. If we fast forward to 2050, we'll see that in our developed areas, 86% of our population is in our urban areas, and even in developing countries, it's not going to be in the rural areas, it's going to be in the metropolitan areas. That's where our people are. That's where we're going to have to make sure that we get our food. And so I see this as a national program leader of helping to solve immediate and near-term problems. We need to focus on our urban situation in this regard. And where in the United States are we finding that our populations are going to be? We have basically 11 emerging mega regions. One of them you're sitting in right now, which goes from Washington, D.C. to Boston. We have the Great Lakes. We have the triangle in North Carolina going all the way to Atlanta, Georgia, South Florida, the Gulf Coast going down to South Texas, the Texas, Houston, Dallas-Fort Worth, San Antonio Triangle, the region across the mountains from Denver all the way down to Albuquerque, Phoenix to Tucson, Southern California, which includes San Diego and Los Angeles, San Francisco, and the Pacific Northwest. I would say, by and large, probably most of the people in this room are in one of those mega regions already, and that's where our populations are going to be. And I'm saying this because we need to think about growing within that and making sure that we can get the production to where the people are. This is one solution to the world's population, not necessarily one I subscribe to, but there's always extreme views in every aspect that we consider. So with the 2050 increase of 9 to 10 million people, we're needing to have a 70% increase in food. Now, you can do the math and say, well, okay, 7 to 10 billion is a 30% increase. Why 70%? Because we also have to take into consideration the 30 to 40 and sometimes even greater amount of food loss and waste that happens within the world, both in the developing and in the developing and developed countries. And where are we going to get that solution? It's going to come from technology, which Dr. Jacob Jung mentioned earlier. So also, where is it going to come from as far as the food itself? The current Western diet, which is basically made up of heavily animal protein-based diet, it takes 2 football fields or 1.3 acres to produce enough food for one person in a Western diet per year. If we then did the extreme again and we ended up taking all of that land and having a plant-based protein food system, we could now feed 1,400% more people. We don't need to do that. And on top of it, the emerging economies and emerging populations, they're not going to want to eat a plant-based diet. They are also looking forward to eating, to some degree, a more animal protein-based diet. So here are your two extremes. Obviously, as history will teach us, the solution is going to be somewhere in between. And to be able to do that, we're going to have to deal with trade, which moves things around the world to solve where our needs are, private investment, but primarily three-fifths of this answer is going to come from research, both public and private. So one of the things, since we're dealing with a large urban population, I would say we need to look at urban and community agriculture. And we have a research center right here in Washington, D.C., the Beltsville Agricultural Research Center, which is perfectly placed to potentially be a center of excellence for urban and community agriculture research. From our own metro system, we see that we can deal with that, where we have our metro, which runs over roads, which is going to be great in the wintertime if this is something that they build. We don't have to deal with the snow. But then on top of the metro itself, we can actually grow a lot of plants and some animal or at least aquaculture-based protein to the immediate populations within our mega regions. Or we can actually change the face of some of the buildings that we live in and let them actually be production centers within our urban centers. But we're already doing some of this. This isn't new. We're already doing some of this, and we need to do more of it. Not one. One of the greatest cities is achieving this is New York City when it comes to growing horticultural produce on its rooftops. But it's not just New York City. Detroit is doing it, where they're doing urban redevelopment from burned out or distressed areas. And Atlanta, Georgia is a mega city dealing with urban agriculture. And here, our USDA, we're not behind the eight ball at all. We're right out front in east of the Witten Building, where Shavonda and Simon sit. We have urban agriculture display as far as ideas on what when tourists come and look by this. We also have in the USDA an urban community agricultural toolkit, which you can achieve by Googling Urban Ag Toolkit USDA, and it deals with the business plan, land and soil quality, water issues that Dr. Shavonda Jacob Jung mentioned, financing, and also production, marketing, and food safety and storage issues, which is something I want to talk about in a little bit. So the other thing, to be able to do this, we must always consider that we're doing it in a sustainable way and a safe and nutritious way. If we look at the current food pyramid, we see that a lot of the produce that we're involved here in horticulture, which is at the bottom of the pyramid, the one that we need to eat a lot more of, which is fruits and vegetables, which is very encouraging. I'm not particularly pleased that donuts and cookies are not something we should be eating. That's that distresses me. From an environmental standpoint, from a sustainable aspect, the fruits and vegetables, and fortunately cookies, are not a big problem environmentally. So this is something that we need to make sure that we're taking into consideration if we're moving our concept of production. The other one that was mentioned earlier this morning is water. Water is going to be a major, major problem. We're finding with our environmental stewardship researchers that even irrigation of agriculture fields, even in traditionally rain-fed areas, improves our crop efficiencies. But as you know, water is not evenly distributed. We're flooding out here in the Northeast this year, and the Pacific West is burning up, literally. But we can do something about it. Even a little bit at a time is going to help. So, you know, as President George W. Bush, 1,000 points of light, 1,000 areas where we could do just small things do matter in solving the problem. And in horticulture, when it comes to fruit and vegetable washing, fruit and vegetable processing, we can reduce our water use, or we can reclaim our water use. These are some of the things that some of my scientists certainly could be considering. Also, climate effects greatly impacts the quality of the fruit and vegetables that we eat. Here's a whole list of factors that are affected by climate, and it's particularly primary and secondary metabolites, which affects nutrition, taste, aroma, texture, and color. And that's the basis upon which our population even consumes fruits and vegetables. Here is a study, just a very brief study, where they grew spinach in the wintertime down near the equator because it was a mild growing condition, or they grew the same varieties up near the pole in the summertime. And some of the people say, well, for cool season crops, just move them higher up into the globe or up near the equator, or up near the poles, produce the same thing. But we can see here that in lutein and beta-carotene, which are energy-storing compounds, yes, we do get an increase in those components in spinach leaves, but vitamin E, which is a major transporter of electrons and energy in the photosynthetic system, significantly drops off, and that's going to impact proteins and sugars and other things in our plant material. So we have to look at this specifically. So where are we? In feeding the 9 billion people, we realize that a lot of the answer is going to come more from our plant sources, which you scientists are dealing with. It's going to have to be sustainable by addressing water and climate. And then finally, we're going to need to repurpose our post-harvest lost in waste, which I said at the very beginning of my presentation. Where is the annual food loss in waste per person? Not surprisingly, it's in the developed areas, North America, Australasia, and Europe. And the household waste, fortunately, the waste in milk and red meats is not as significant as it is for grain products, fruits and vegetables, and primarily fish. And these are very conservative figures. I was looking with the Economic Research Service that fruits, vegetables, and fish are now up around about 40%. So it's going the wrong direction, unfortunately. We have some solutions to this, albeit a few, in the Agricultural Research Service. Our Fort Pierce Laboratory developed a method by which they could attach a chlorine dioxide sachet to the top of a box that holds strawberries. It doesn't touch the strawberries. It emits a fungal-controlling atmosphere, and so that when you store strawberries on your kitchen counter for 6 days at room temperature, with the treatment, the strawberries don't develop mold, whereas without the treatment, we've all unfortunately seen this way too often. Also, we're dealing with post-harvest loss and waste, where we're dealing with either fruits and vegetables that don't make the premium grade. What do we do with this? The answer is not the landfill, but actually repurposing it. Our laboratory in Albany, California, where it makes purees out of this, and forming technologies where we have commercialized fruit and vegetable health and nutrition bars, or casting technologies where you can actually make sushi wraps out of it, or wrap a ham in it, which when it's baked, the wrap actually melts into the ham versus a fresh jelly or jam. As you know, the water in that and the fat in the ham don't mix. It falls off and burns in your oven. Or we can actually use this wrapping technology because it's acidic. We can wrap it around fish fillets, and that'll keep the fish fillet lasting longer in the market and in your home refrigerator for a much longer period of time. It doesn't detract from the flavor of the fish, but helps in the preservation of it. These are just a few technologies that we're already addressing. And then, of course, we've got waste of materials that we sometimes don't think about, wine grapes and olive pomace, where you can make flowers out of it and make crackers, and, of course, grapeseed oil making an oil, and then also in rice hulls and potato skins. As you know, we have a tremendous number of potato skins as a result of our attraction to French fries. And we, in our Albany laboratory, have developed, and it's been commercialized, where you take potato skins and you repurpose it into disposable plates, bowls, and cups that will allow us to get away from styrofoam, which is not decomposable in our landfills, or taking rice hulls and making it into utensils, which are not only don't break on you, which most of them do when I go to the cafeteria every day to eat those plastic knives and forks, but is also heat tolerant and is disposable or biodegradable in our landfills. But one thing that I think will hopefully bring this open as to where are our efforts, this is a recent information from our Economic Research Service, and I only want to basically look at the bottom two components. I'm just about done, is what you're saying? Okay. And where do I see some potential solutions to our problems? So if we look at, as the Economic Research Service put a dollar, and since we have 100 pennies in the dollar, we can look at this as percentage. Because of research since the 1950s, and the millions, if not billions of dollars, and scientific hours spent on producing the fruits and vegetables and the animal products that we consume today, it only takes less than 8 cents of your consuming dollar. However, to take those fruits and vegetables and animal products and to put it into a form that can be marketable and that we can consume is almost three times as much of what it takes to produce it in the first place. If we're going to improve the food availability and the cost, a 50% reduction in food and vegetable processing, packaging, and preservation will get us further ahead than if we had a 100% reduction in just the production of the stuff in the first place. Thank you very much.